Hi, everyone, and welcome to this month's podcast where we're talking to Paul Breloff. Paul is the CEO of Shortlist, which he'll tell us all about. So very welcome, Paul.
Great to be here, Cherry.
Paul, I was surprised to hear that you're actually a lawyer by training. Why were you not interested in pursuing the law?
Yeah, it was not that I wasn't interested in law. It was more that I was called to other things more. Going into law school, I wasn't really sure why I was going to law school. It was a period of life where I was trying to figure out what was calling to me in the world. I liked that law combined, at least felt like it combined, this intellectual exploration of how the world's put together and how policies are made, but also practical. You can still do something in the world, unlike, say, a philosophy PhD, which I was also thinking about.
Philosophy PhD, wow.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, which would have been very impractical, and as much as I think it would have probably been fun.
It would have been fun, yeah.
I'm very glad I didn't do that as a profession.
But you went to Yale Law School, which is one of the best law schools in the world. How did that experience shape your understanding of what law practice requires? Maybe that's the off-putting thing.
Yeah, no, I think Yale's a funny law school because the joke is that it's not really a law school.
Oh, really?
It doesn't teach you to do law. It teaches you to go be a politician. You know, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but J.D. Vance, our incoming vice president, went to school at about the same time as me. I went to school with a very famous U.S. Senator, Josh Hawley. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton met at Yale Law School.
Yeah, they did.
And many of the Supreme Court justices. And so I think that it doesn't really teach you necessarily how to be a good lawyer. It teaches you how to think like a lawyer, of course, but also how to think about how law interacts with the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that, although frankly, I probably would have enjoyed it more if it was more practical. I found that as I was going through law school, what I gravitated towards was the much more practical side of things. And so what I ended up spending a lot of time on and what led to my future career in some ways was a community development bank where through a fluke, the law school was given some money to set up a community development bank. No one knew what that meant. A bunch of us law students raised our hands, said, we don't know what it means, but we'll go figure it out. And it embarked on a kind of a two-year journey of really digging into the interplay between financial services and community economic development. And
I mean, that is very broad for a law school, like, you know, degree type thing. You would expect that you're doing, you know, courses, but that is actually how you got into understanding finance and then
absolutely
community and the impact that it could have.
Absolutely.
Oh,
and
I
so
see.
I think mm-hmm. that there was a direct link between coming out of law school, and I really had two interest areas, both at the intersection of business and economic development or social benefit. One was real estate and thinking more about real estate as a tool of development. And I actually went and practiced law for one short year, primarily.
This is when you were at Mayor Brown.
Yeah, okay. As a corporate and real estate mm-hmm. attorney. Mm-hmm. The other interest was microfinance and the role that financial services could play in helping small businesses grow and making it easier for mm-hmm. low-income households to mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, when I was doing the research on you, you have had like a very diverse
career.
So I'm going to look at the list again. So you were in advertising for some time. Mm-hmm. So you did your Mad Men era. Mm-hmm. You ran a fintech, the Action Venture Labs. Mm-hmm. Then you led a microfinance institution in India.
I didn't lead it, but yes. It was a senior
executive. So it says lead. Senior executive. Yeah. Okay. And then you worked as a lawyer. So you've done all of it to come to Shortlist. Maybe we should start. What is Shortlist? And maybe that can give a better picture of.
And it has been mm-hmm. a journey. I think the through line of my career has mm-hmm. been trying to find the intersection of impact and capitalism and how do you make capitalism work for good rather mm-hmm. than bad mm-hmm. And innovation. I like doing new things. I like doing things that haven't been tried as much. I think Shortlist came out of this recognition of running an impact investing fund, investing in startups across Africa, Asia, Latin America, and seeing that very consistently we would give them money and then their next problem was immediately people.
Yeah.
And while there's a lot of focus on fundraising and capital allocation, there's very little focus on how do you build a great team? Where do you find people? How do you develop them? How do you retain them? When in reality, most people, if pressed, would admit that's what makes or breaks a startup. That's what makes or break a company. So Shortlist emerged from this recognition that there was a lot of people allocating capital. There weren't as many people thinking about human capital and the role that human capital plays in successful businesses, in driving innovation. We didn't know what the business would be when we started it. We knew what problem we wanted to focus on: human capital, jobs. We initially started as much more of a tech business. We had a series of tools that made it easy to assess candidates, get to know candidates. So we were almost like an intelligence layer between the chaos of job boards and actual precious time interviewing and talking to candidates, trying to figure out who's a good fit. As we went into market, as we built the product, as we were licensing that to companies, we realized that to really solve the problem we wanted to solve, we had to get much more hands-on. And so through kind of around the same time as COVID, we started to make a transformation or pivot into a much more hands-on service business. So today, Shortlist does two main things. We do executive search, and we've become one of Africa's biggest executive search firms, probably the biggest that serves what we think of as the impact and innovation sectors.
Yes.
Startups, NGOs, philanthropies, investors. The other side, Shortlist Futures, is a workforce innovation lab, which is exactly as fuzzy as it sounds. But generally speaking, we're interested in solving problems at the nexus of economic growth and job creation. So we look out and figure out what are the areas that more young people could get jobs, or more people across Africa in general could get jobs. That has led us to do a lot of work in green economy and the green economic transition, and digital jobs.
Yeah.
And so we run a series of programs, happy to get into more detail, but generally trying to get more Kenyans and Africans linked up into career track positions in these
so training.
Fields. It's actually not training. It's a common misconception. Okay. Because a lot of people think that the first step to getting someone a job is training. Usually not. Education isn't our problem. It's all of the other things around getting work experience. We're right now, typically, I think I've seen the statistic here that the average time it takes a college grad to find a sustainable employment can be 5 years.
Gosh.
So the issue is usually not, there are positions that require specialized training. Most positions are learn on the job.
Okay.
And so what we do is design programs that make it easier, quicker, and reduce friction to getting more young people into work experiences. This often means internship programs, apprenticeship programs, places where we're making it much easier for companies to access these people, to interview these people. We're sometimes also layering in some subsidy where we actually pay some of the people's wages for some period of time to incentivize companies take them on, give them this on-the-job training. Because I think what most people are missing right now, it's not education, it's exposure to great standards and great standard work, wherever that could be.
Yeah.
And so we're just trying to get more people.
Where do you get the money for the subsidies?
Yeah. So we design these programs in partnership with philanthropies and donors.
Okay.
The macro picture is a fascinating and scary and potentially high opportunity one, where 11 million Africans enter the workforce every year for 3 million jobs.
Yeah.
So we really do have a jobs crisis. We don't have a talent crisis. We have all the talent in the world, but it's a where do we get people productively working? There are a lot of foundations and donors and government agencies around the world and within Africa that really care about that.
Yeah.
And so what we do is come with some ideas, help use the funders as partners to shape those ideas, and then implement those usually with their funding. Sometimes employers and private sector actors pay something.
Okay.
Many times it's all funded by the donors.
I have so many questions emanating from this. The first one is on Shortlist itself.
Yeah.
You said that you started off thinking it was a fintech company, but actually you figured out that it's more hands-on. But we are all talking about AI and how AI is going to shape the world and how human capital will be decreased as a result of the AI, the place that AI can take in the world. How do you feel about that kind of conversation? Is it true? Do we need a human experience, or is AI going to take over?
We think a lot about AI. The honest answer is nobody knows.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I don't trust anybody who says they know, because I think the future around AI is really unclear. I think of it like a slow-moving black swan event, an event that you really can't predict where we go from here. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because the jagged frontier of AI innovation, there are some things that AI can do really well today that is shocking. There's other very simple things like basic math that it can't do.
Yeah.
And which sometimes mm-hmm. each new model has an entirely different jagged frontier. That makes it tough to predict and tough to sense where it's going. The other issue is just human systems. Technology can do one thing, but can only move at the speed at which human systems can adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very unclear. My personal view is, unfortunately, I think AI is poised to make some pretty significant impacts on labor demand. A lot of what we had focused on was remote digital work, people sitting in Kenya, around Africa, but working for global organizations in different ways.
And so just so that I can, yeah. I can be clear, because it's an executive search, I would have thought that it's at a very high level. Are you saying that you're placing people?
This is much more on the shortlist future
side,
which is much more early career.
Okay, fine.
No, and shortlist search we can talk about, but is a whole different business that is still hands-on and I don't think is very impacted by AI.
By AI.
Certainly because
of the level of skill that is needed for that, for those kind of jobs.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I think that AI is going to come for junior positions first. It certainly can do a lot of things. You're probably seeing within the practice of law.
Yeah.
It can do a lot of things that might take a first, second, third year associate many, many hours or days. It can do it in minutes. It's kind of amazing. I don't think it will disrupt the senior talent landscape quickly.
Okay.
I think the junior talent landscape, though, AI can already do a lot of the tasks that some of these digital jobs are. So I think that's scary.
Yeah.
On the optimistic side, we are trying to figure out what are the silver linings, what are the positive use cases. We've actually just launched a fund with Gates Foundation that will focus on funding and learning alongside innovative generative AI use cases to promote women's economic empowerment, specifically looking at ways that generative AI can be used to improve incomes through access to markets, access to finance, access to knowledge, access to jobs. And so we are actually just launching that right now and we'll get into full swing next year. So we are hopeful that we will absolutely find some positive use cases. I do think it's something we all have to keep our eye on as we look ahead.
Yeah. The other question I have is on the executive search function. For that, is it businesses coming to you and saying, look, we're looking for someone at the senior level, please recommend someone? Is that how it works?
That's right. Except it's less about recommending someone and more about managing a full end-to-end process on behalf of the client to figure out who's the best person.
Okay.
And this is something we didn't do any executive search before about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. My co-founder and I knew nothing about it. Before we started this company, we thought exec search was this silly space where, you know, you sit down with an exec search consultant for coffee and then they just kind of like give you a name.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not good executive search. That's that some people might do it that way, but that's quite bad. Mm-hmm. It's actually a very structured process where you're using your market intelligence, your industry awareness, as well as your database to work with a client to really uncover what are they looking for, figure out where would that ideal person come from. So you're looking at what archetypes of person, what roles, what companies might this person come from. You're using the mix of your database, your networks, as well as LinkedIn research to figure out who's the universe of potential people.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's kind of a lot of legwork to call all those people, figure out, might you be a fit for this, sell the opportunity, engage their interest. Most of the best candidates aren't looking for jobs. Most of them are in a job and you have to entice them into something that might be better.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a lot of work. And then actually just managing the entire process to make sure the interviews are getting done, there's good decision-making, the offers are negotiated. So as we realized, it is much closer to management consulting as related to people and important critical hires. And so sometimes people look at us and they're like, boy, you seem very expensive. Why don't you just send me some people? And we'll send them people for free because we want to emphasize that's not where you should be getting value. If you choose to hire us, it's because you kind of want this partner to do all of these steps.
Yeah, I mean, it's at a very, very high level and very sophisticated. So, but looking across the continent, do you notice patterns of where these people are emerging from? Is it based on, you know, what we would typically think of education, opportunity? You know, is it Nigeria? Is it Kenya? Is it South Africa? Is that where most of the candidates, the focus is?
A lot of the roles that we work on are in the places you might expect.
Yeah.
So we do a lot of work in Kenya and a lot of work in East Africa, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, mm-hmm. some in Egypt. Talent is coming from all over.
Yeah.
We're typically hiring people that are 8 to 20 years into their career. So education usually matters less than what have you actually done in your career? What have you accomplished? I think some of the, there's no rules here, but some of what we've seen is that people who have managed to get global exposure tend to do really well because there's just a greater awareness of how to interact in multicultural environments. Even if you're a Ugandan getting hired into a Kenyan company, like having been exposed to how different companies can be and how standards can change is a really useful backdrop.
Yeah.
And so I think that for younger professionals, if there's opportunities to work for a UK business for a year or two, work for a Nigerian business for a year or two, if you're a Kenyan, I think that's really valuable. The other thing is I do think startups and the emergence of a startup sector in Kenya over the last 10 to 15 years has been very positive for mm-hmm. talent development
mm-hmm.
because whereas sometimes traditional corporates, it's much more you get your position and then you're I hate to say this, oftentimes almost like moving paper around. You're like a cog in a bureaucracy and you're not necessarily learning how to think with agility and creativity. There's a not necessarily a fast pace around you. Whereas startups teach you to be quite dynamic, teach you to be agile, be creative in how you solve problems. It's understood that you come in and you're probably not given a super clear job title. You just have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And that process of figuring it out is some of the very best experience you can get in the first 5 to 10 years. We are entering a period of history that is wildly volatile, wildly crazy. I think the more people can be exposed
and
to
adapt,
some of that
I guess.
And adapt, the better.
Yeah. So from that, do you see an emergence of the cultural nuances between different candidates that affect the way in which they think and the way in which they can be positioned into companies?
Yeah, definitely. I think that it's hard to generalize, but I think that is one of the things that as we are evaluating fit, mm-hmm. we're looking at. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get a sense of what is the company culture. And when I say culture, I mean I'm not just kind of like a fuzzy sense, but more like concretely, what are the norms or behaviors that seem to dominate this kind of company? Is this the kind of company that's kind of loose and divergent thinking and creative and people show up for impromptu brainstorming sessions and then, you know, scatter and do things? Or is this a company that, like, you know, writes, you know, very responsive emails within 5 hours of receiving emails, shows up in meetings on time, schedules everything in like an electronic calendar?
How would you know though? You would have to have had
you can get
done
a sense,
it.
Okay. From the internet. It's almost more meta.
Okay.
So you're evaluating like what kind of company is this? And then what is the manager like?
Mm-hmm.
Who is this person reporting to? How will they get along? What is their team like? And you can get a good sense from even just the interactions as part of the search process.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're sending across candidates, does someone typically respond within a day or not? Do they respond in complete sentences or not? Do they prefer kind of like quick WhatsApps that are a little bit chaotic and all over the place, or do they want you to send you a structured document? Do they show up on time to the meetings you have scheduled, or they show up while picking up their kids from school and in a bit of a chaotic state? And you start to pick up like what kinds of people.
Okay. I mean, the real question, I guess, for any candidate that's listening is what can they do to make themselves, and you said it, I think you've said it right, that most of the candidates you'd be looking for at an executive level would not necessarily be looking for a role.
Yeah.
But if there are people who are looking for roles, what kind of things can they do in order to best prepare themselves for an executive position, such as the ones that you guys are looking for?
Yeah, I'd say two things jump top to mind. One is know yourself. I'm surprised how many people might get tripped up by a question as simple as, tell me about yourself. and start going all over the place. Knowing yourself means knowing like what are your most what accomplishments are you most proud of? It means knowing, like, what do you think of as your strengths and weaknesses? And not so that you can answer a question on weaknesses like, I work too hard. That's not what I mean. I mean genuinely. Yeah. What are the contexts in which you thrive? What are the contexts in which you struggle? And that helps you evaluate fit as well. So knowing yourself. The other is approach your job search or any career transition like an entrepreneur. Don't think of it as a passive activity of clicking apply and hoping for the best. I think the people that get the best outcomes, whether it's applying for a job or creating their own job, are the people that if they see a job that's posted that they're interested in, they figure out who is the hiring manager, who is the HR manager, and how can I get introduced to that person. Whether or not they talk to you isn't the point. The point is that you kind of got into their inbox, and I can tell you as a recruiter, 9 times out of 10, that will get you onto the interview list.
Yeah.
And that's your first task and as jobs are posted. If it's not a job posted, I think that 70 to 80% of all jobs are never posted online or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of creating your own job. And the way to do that, I think, is there's no easy way to guarantee it works, but generally find an organization and or a person that you're interested in. Try to figure out a way to ideally get an introduction to them, but reach out and keep reaching out in a polite way. And then try to explore what problems are they trying to solve. And then you map your own talents and experiences onto that to see where you can help.
Mm-hmm.
I've done this a few times where I kind of go into people and I explain, hey, I'm not asking you, do you have a job? Because if I ask somebody, like if you get asked, do you have a job? You're immediately defensive and you're looking for reasons to let this person down. Instead, you say, what problems are you interested in? What are you trying to solve right now? What are you thinking about the most? And if that corresponds to things you're good at or are interested in as well, you can, in that session, brainstorm how you might be able to help. You can follow up with an email saying, hey, how about I do these 3 or 4 things?
Yeah.
I actually did that in several instances where I said, you can pay me very little, or in some cases, I'll work for a few weeks unpaid so that we can get a sense of how we work together.
Yeah.
That is something I don't see people doing very much, but it's often a way, particularly if you're mid to later in your career, you know what you want, but you don't know how to get your foot in the door, can be an approach.
I think that is a tall order for, and this is again, something that is cultural.
Absolutely.
It would be very difficult to see someone actually, especially at a senior level, emailing and doing, but it takes that kind of courage, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And courage is rewarded. And I do think it's one of the things, this is not true across Africa, but within Kenya, I think I see that there's a wonderful politeness and humility.
Yes.
That in a certain part of the job market can be a disadvantage.
I actually agree with that a lot. And even for junior people, I think getting that courage at an earlier level is much more beneficial, so that by the time that you get to the senior level, it's not a challenge for you.
Exactly.
Okay. So having built this business, Shortlist and Shortlist Futures, how has the journey been? Because you're an entrepreneur at the end of the day. How is the journey of being an entrepreneur?
So much more difficult than I thought.
Really?
It's funny because before Shortlist, I had been an intrapreneur. Hmm. 5 or 6 times where I had from scratch set up something new, but within an umbrella organization.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm pretty good at this. Like, I know how to start things. There is something fundamentally different between starting something within an organization and starting something with no safety net, with no help. I remember the early days of Shortlist, we'd be having some weird finance or entity issue. And in the olden days, I would say, cool, go talk to the finance team.
Yeah.
But now it's like, we don't really have a finance team.
Yeah.
I guess I have to go Google this and I have to figure out who to call for help. And
mm-hmm.
and there's this dynamic of no safety net that's interesting. As CEO and co-founder also, there's just a lot of weight on your shoulders that's different from a day-to-day job.
Mm-hmm.
When I hear my wife have a tough day at the office and complain about work, it's a very different dynamic when you complain about a big corporate you work for versus your own business.
Business, yeah.
Where frankly, you're kind of caught in this weird squeeze where you have to maintain positivity and motivation and clarity of thought and all of this for your team. You also have to do that for your quote unquote bosses, your board of directors, your investors, your shareholders. And so you realize one of the challenges, and this is getting more attention now, is mental health can suffer because you get burned out. You're always faking it till you make it, and that can get exhausting. I know that this is oftentimes I try to make it look relatively clean and easy.
I mean, you're making it sound very relatively
not
easy.
Been easy. Mm-hmm. There have been so many sleepless nights. I remember when we first fundraised. I think lots of times there's this myth when someone sees that someone raised money, they're like, ugh. It came so easy to them. And I know that like when we raised our first $1 million, I was very proud of that, but we had to talk to 190 investors, many of those multiple conversations, and 187 of them said no.
Yeah.
And that's no, those are not fake numbers. Those are real numbers. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when I hear people say, "Ugh, this system is rigged. I talked to 4 investors and they shot me down." It's like, yeah, no, you have to talk, you have to be relentless. And then once those people shot you down, you reach out back again in a month and you update them on your progress. And you say, "Hey, we're seeing great progress here. Can I interest you in another chat? I'd love to share what we're learning."
Yeah.
I think it's bruising the whole process, but also there's a different kind of pride as well. When you kind of can get some critical distance on it and look at it and you say, wow, cool. I played a really big role in this thing existing. People have jobs, we're having impact. Yeah. It can be very rewarding.
Shortlist is in Kenya, or have you diversified across Africa?
We work across Africa. We don't have offices anywhere.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, we have become a fully distributed team. Okay. We're experimenting with a number of ways in which we're investing in tech platforms to bring people together. We invest a lot in travel.
Yeah.
People are traveling around a lot so that we have in-person time. But we now have teammates in Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal, Egypt, South Africa.
Gosh.
I think Mauritius, UK, India, from before. So no, we're a quite distributed team. Okay. Still though, lean and mean. We're only about 45 people globally.
And since 2016, right?
Yeah, since 2016.
Okay. I mean, it's quite an achievement even to be going and thriving all those years later.
Thank you. It wasn't always thriving. And you never know what next year will bring.
In terms of like so that I'm clear, you don't represent individuals, you just represent companies.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And in fact, if you do have any professionals listening, oftentimes people think, oh, I need to go to coffee with executive search consultants. Actually, no. Usually exec search consultants won't have time for that because they're constantly interviewing people for specific open roles. But what they can do is very much, whether it's sending me an email or sending an email to Shortlist, we have a link. We very much want executives to be in our database. We want to know what jobs do you want? How much money do you want to make? What other things are you looking for? And that is very important and a huge source of how we find people for the roles. At any given time, Shortlist is working on about 80 open leadership
80.
Roles.
80, that's huge. 80.
Yeah, we do a lot.
Yeah.
Across the continent. Mm. And talking to me or any one search consultant, I could only tell you about 5 or 6 that we're working on. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't help really to speak to one person. It helps to get in our database. If someone emails me at paul@shortlist.net, I then get you into the database and then circulate you to the search consultants in case there's anything across the team.
That's a great tip for anyone who's listening so that they can send you an email. You'll be bombarded after this.
That's fine.
So let's talk about, Paul, the highs and the highs and the lows of the lows. What can you tell us has been the highs so far and then the lows?
I think the highs have been those moments where we're able to create a program.
I want a specific research example.
Yeah, like I'll give you one example from this past year that was very rewarding. We have been working for the last 6 years on a variety of clean energy and climate talent programs, where we try to put young people into jobs. We've placed about 8,000 young people Wow. into full-time jobs Wow. Across Africa, across about 200 employers. We realized we were being very reactive. We realized nobody had done research trying to forecast where will green jobs be coming from in the future? What are the sources of labor demand? What are the trainings that people need to get if they want to be ready for the job opportunities in 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now? No one had done that work. We didn't have the money to do that work. So we embarked on a pretty aggressive process to try to find someone to fund it, someone to help us do it. And we managed to partner with FSD Africa. We brought on BCG to do the analysis. And this earlier this year, published this report, Forecasting Green Jobs in Africa. It's about 100 slides and a deep Excel database that has been incredibly useful to us. And as we've heard from others, to the sector, as they actually get a clear, granular picture of where will the jobs be?
I mean, that's a great resource. Yeah, we should link it in this.
Yeah, happy to. Yeah. And I think when we can do something like that, that feels like a genuine contribution, and we're able to do it and kind of look in the mirrors and say, wow, this was something we got to do as our jobs,
yeah.
as business.
Yeah.
And hopefully it will be really useful to a lot of people over time.
Yeah. Aside from green, and everything green is very, you know, in vogue at the moment, where else do you see the job market going if someone is young and looking to see where can I place myself?
Yeah, I would have said digital, and I still think there's opportunities in digital, but they've changed in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. If I was a young person interested in tech and digital, I would just learn how to use a variety of AI platforms to do specific things better. It's mm-hmm. less about learning to become an AI engineer. Don't waste your time with that. And it's not about going and taking a training course in any particular platform. It's about thinking whatever kind of sector you like, architecture, law, finance, marketing, whatever it is, go figure out what are the AI tools getting built that are supposed to help, learn how they work, practice doing things, doing specific things with them. And I do think that AI can be a huge career accelerant and global leveler of talent. Whereas even if you started as a mediocre marketing person, mm-hmm. Using AI tools, you may accelerate into being among the best in the world very quickly. Mm. And I think that'll create a lot of opportunities. Yeah. I also think creative industries generally, thinking more about how music, entertainment, art, sports, which is a little bit different, but related.
Even in Africa, you think that's
very much, very much. Mm-hmm. I think that generally speaking, there are of course lots and lots of opportunities in local economies with local companies, mm-hmm. but those opportunities are not growing fast enough to keep everyone busy.
Okay.
So you do need to look at what can you quote unquote export? What are things the world will pay for? In dollars, ideally, or pounds, yeah. or euros, or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what will the world pay for that we can share?
Yeah.
And that can be your digital skills, which is not bound in by any border. That can be artwork. That can be music. I mean, mm-hmm. seeing Burna Boy at the All-Star weekend was, a really interesting moment of recognition. Thinking about watching the local Nairobi City Thunder win this Basketball Africa League berth, and the ways that can open up into an NBA franchise. That's exciting. Those are little pockets of economic development and opportunity creation that I think are exciting.
Yeah.
So it's almost letting people follow like their intrinsic passions a little bit more and opening up to those.
I love that idea, because when I was definitely going to university, there was no discussion of passions. It was definitely do something that is going to guarantee your future.
Yeah.
I like that idea. In terms of looking for traditional jobs and merging them with AI, do you still need the qualifications? If you're an architect or if you're a lawyer, do you still need to be actually able to practice before you can then, to then seamlessly merge the AI Yeah. Just for young people, you can't just say, oh, I'm interested in law, but I just don't want to be a lawyer, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. You might know better than me as the lawyer, but the,
I actually don't know because you could do away with the qualification and just rely simply on the,
law is a great example. I believe this is a somewhat controversial cutting edge area of law is what, at least in the United States, what constitutes the practice of law.
Yeah.
If you send a client request for a specific contract form into AI and it spits you out a first draft, is that a practice of law? It's unclear because right now in the United States, at least, you have to be barred. You have to have graduated from law school and been barred somewhere.
The same. The same here.
Same here. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think it's changing. I think there's different. I think people are figuring out what are the limits. Where does it fit? I think it's probably easiest to start in places where you don't need any sort of certification. Mm. Coding, data science, marketing. Those are all areas where nobody expects you to necessarily have gone to school. You might have gone to school to have learned it, but you don't have to.
Yeah.
There's plenty of self-taught data scientists, self-taught software engineers. So I think starting maybe there would make more sense, but let's see.
Okay. And what about the low-lows of this year?
Of this year in particular?
I think
the low-lows are moments where you're just dealing with deep self-doubt. And you don't know where to turn with that. I found raising money, particularly the second time, to be an excruciating experience where every day I had to show up and bring this like shining smile and optimism to tell the story of Shortlist and how we would take over the world and make everyone's dreams come true. While most days I did not believe that.
Yeah.
Most days I believe that, like, I have no idea if this business is working. I don't know if we're on the right path. I have a lot of data points that say we're not on the right path, but I have to kind of like gloss
sell it
over those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the strategies that I came upon was almost creating an alter ego. I created an alter ego named Travis, who was...
It's like Beyonce and her alter ego.
Exactly.
That's so funny.
Sasha Fierce. Yes, it comes from that. It comes from that. Yeah, yeah. And it's essentially, I became this guy, Travis, that was entirely confident. When someone asked me a question, my normal instinct when someone asked me a question is, well, on this hand this, on this hand that, or I'm not sure, admit I don't know. Never would admit I didn't know. I'd look them straight in the eyes, give them a straight answer, and try to give them what they want, even though it wasn't me.
Yeah.
That was one way that I could come to terms with what felt like a deeply inauthentic experience. It takes a psychological toll. And it's part of the reason that we've shifted Shortlist to try to stand on our own 2 feet. We are not big time profitable, but we're a profitable business that doesn't need venture capital anymore.
Yeah.
And part of that has allowed me to then become a more honest, authentic leader. Like, I don't know that I could have been on a podcast saying, I really don't know if we're right or wrong in the middle of a fundraise. I really feel for entrepreneurs of all ages. I see them across Kenya, across Africa, working on big problems, and it can be really difficult navigating like investors and the market. So yeah, those moments of self-doubt have been low.
I think that's a very honest answer. In terms of, I guess we didn't even get to young Paul, where did you think you were going to, like when you were in school, what did you think you were going to
do? I had no idea. I think when I was young, I in fact wrote an essay when I was like 10 or 11 where I was determined to be an archaeologist.
I love it.
And a lot of that was based on a misplaced notion of Indiana Jones and what archaeology meant. But it's interesting to the extent to which I have now as an adult obviously not been an archaeologist and I'm not Indiana Jones, but have been able to build a career where, in addition to just trying to build good businesses, I've really gravitated towards stretching myself into culturally unfamiliar and sometimes uncomfortable situations. It's been a source of pride that Shortlist has, I believe right now, people from 8 or 9 nationalities, all with different approaches and backgrounds and experiences. And so building kind of multicultural teams.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I was young, I didn't know. And I'm from a very small town where you know, wasn't exposed to the world.
What's the small town?
It's called Lockport, New York. It's okay. A wonderful 20,000 person town.
20,000?
Yeah. Oh. So it's kind of small, mid-sized. And there was, when I was growing up, there was a factory there that made air conditioning moldings, and it employed a good percentage of the town. And sadly, over the last 15 years, it's one of many factories that have shut down. And so it's still a lovely place to be, but it has evolved a lot as a location. But there wasn't, you know, like maybe once every several months we would drive into the big city of Buffalo, which most people don't think of as a big city. They think of it as quite a small city. So I think when I was young, I wasn't really aware of what opportunities were out there. I only started to see the range of things you could do in the world probably after I graduated college, not before. And it's part of what motivates some of our work is recognizing that a lot of young people have no idea what jobs they should be interested in. They ask their parents for advice, and their parents might say, go work at a bank or go work at a telco if you can
stability,
get the job.
Stability.
Insurance company. Whereas in reality, a lot of the growth there is not a lot of parents are probably telling their kids, oh my gosh, the green transition is going to change everything. Figure out a way to be working on climate. That will be like a guarantee of job security to the future. Most people aren't thinking that way.
But that message needs to be much more, it can't be disseminated just at this level. It needs be at the, you know, from a public perception level, and from parents who are, you know, taking their children to school and expecting them to do the traditional jobs that they wish they had done.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Predictions for 2025.
Wow, it's a pretty dynamic moment. So predictions are dangerous.
Yeah.
I think one is we will absolutely start to see AI filter into day-to-day life more. Normally, I would say I would be more skeptical of that, but I think it's become so usable, so cheap, so easy, and there's so many people working on it that I do think we'll see a lot more applications, and I hope we can work on that. I hope that we continue to see progress in growing a diversity of climate positive organizations. I think that over the last decade, across many parts of Africa, there's been a big push around clean energy, and that's very exciting. There's been a big proliferation of household solar and geothermal in Kenya and different creative approaches. I think now we have to broaden beyond that. And so e-mobility and waste remediation, recycling, conservation, developing carbon markets. I can't tell if that'll be this year or a couple years, but I hope we see
all of those are in the conversation. I guess we are also seeing that from a legal perspective because we do documentation. So I can, I can appreciate that. E-mobility, carbon markets, all of that, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, what tips would you give to someone who has an idea, wants to start a business, wants to be, you know, an entrepreneur like you?
Yeah, a couple things. One, fall in love with the problem, not the solution. So I think that there's a tendency when people think of what entrepreneurship means, you need an idea. I don't think you really need an idea. I think you need to know some specific problem or opportunity space generally, some dynamic space where there's new things happening that you can do something new, and then just investigate into it and start something from that. I think that very often your first idea or your first solution won't work. Second one probably won't work. In our case, it was maybe the fourth or fifth one that ended up starting to work. If you're obsessed with your one solution, you get tunnel vision and you probably won't like make it work. Whereas if you're interested, if you're loyal to the problem, not the solution, that can guide you better as a North Star. The other is just do it. I get sometimes frustrated when I hear or see entrepreneurs who are, you know, spending a year or a year and a half talking about an idea and thinking about it, analyzing every which way. You don't really learn anything useful until you've launched something or you're engaged in something or you put your flag in the ground and you say, this is what I'm going to be about. And then that thing will move and change because like once any idea hits the market, it evolves very quickly. But if you really are serious, then you got to start doing something. Doesn't mean you have to quit your job. It doesn't mean you have to go build a PowerPoint slide and raise money, but start doing nights and weekends. Start serving a customer around the problem you have. Make them pay you something to see if there's willingness to pay. See if the next time you do it, it's a little bit better. What did you learn from the first one? And then just kind of growing from there.
Yeah. What is the fifth iteration of Shortlist then?
We are still, the original animating mission hasn't changed and feels more alive than ever. Mm-hmm. We exist to solve human capital challenges to unlock innovation and impact for Africa. Mm-hmm. And that's still true. I think more and more what we're seeing is we can diversify even more across the human capital value chain. Today, we basically do two business units, search for senior,
and then
futures for junior. Mm-hmm. We are next year likely going to launch a new, completely different brand, mid-level recruiting solution. We're launching a career community focused on helping young, ambitious Africans get their first green job. That'll focus on climate and careers in climate and launching a series of things there. We're launching this AI fund to look at how AI can drive more incomes. So I think starting to spread out a little bit and figure out how we can get more creatively involved in addressing these other human capital challenges, I think is exciting. So it's less of a now, I think we're done pivoting. I think our last pivot was in 2020. To be where we are today, I think we're going to stick with the businesses we have, and now it's more about how do we do more.
Yeah,
that's still on mission.
I mean, I think that the solution that the problem that you're solving for is definitely necessary, and I think you've identified that very well. And so we wish you really all the best as you continue to grow, and I hope to see more, more successes for you guys.
Great, thanks so much, Jerry.
You're welcome. But now we have a quick fire round just to get to know you. I just hope that it's Paul answering and not Travis. So
okay, it's been all Paul for the last few years.
You do seem very relaxed, and so maybe that's more
it's much more relaxing to run a startup that doesn't need to go fundraise.
Coming into your own, fundraising. I think it's stressful. Yeah. All right. Quick fire round: beach or city holiday?
None of the above. Mountain. None.
Oh gosh.
I'm more of a bush and mountain and getting as far away from cities as possible.
But where is that? Is that Mount Kenya?
Mount Kenya.
Have you climbed?
Yes.
How many times?
Once. Okay. Would like to do it again in the next year or two.
Up to Lenana, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. I've done that, and I definitely cannot do it again.
One of my favorite experiences.
One of my worst experiences.
It's a bit of a challenge because my wife is city. So yeah. one of our sources of frequent squabbles is about where are we going on vacation.
If it's a city, then which one is her favorite?
She's from New York City, and she will always love New York City. I would pick somewhere else. I think where we agree is Mumbai. We met in Mumbai.
Oh, okay.
We love Mumbai. Mm-hmm. I lived in Mumbai for about 5 years. So I think when we're stuck, we often go back there.
Okay, cool. Favorite place, I guess Mumbai you've answered. Apples or oranges?
In my father is a dentist, retired dentist, so I'll say apples because I grew up learning that an apple a day keeps the dentist and doctor away.
It was the doctor away, yeah. Pizza topping of choice. Being in New York,
because it's
controversial,
I'll say pineapple.
There are
many people that hate that answer, but I like nothing more than the Hawaiian pizza at Pizza 360.
Oh, really?
I think it's terrific. So I'll often try to see if anyone will share it with me, and usually the answer is no.
Favorite drink?
Alcoholic or non-alcoholic?
Any of the above.
I do a fair bit of angel investing here, and one of my angel investments is 254 Brewing.
Oh,
so
nice.
I'll say Sand Trap. I spent many years living in Brooklyn, where everyone's obsessed with IPA. I know that is not normally the palate of most Kenyans, but that's what I was
Tell me, what does IPA stand for? I used to know.
India Pale Ale.
Yeah.
And it means it has a lot of extra hops, so it's very deeply flavorful and intense, which some people don't really like.
Yeah.
I love it. So 254
Sand Trap. Not a fan of the Tusker then.
I like Tusker too. I'm equal opportunity.
Be a drinker.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Paul, for joining us. I think it's been a really good and insightful podcast to learn about what is the future of looking for a role? How do you look for a role? What is the best place to start? What does AI mean for the looking of for executive searches? and for the job market in Africa in general. I think you've been a great guest. Thank you so much.
Jerry.
See you guys next month.